Hey everybody, welcome to episode 116 of the Go Get Outside podcast. This is your host, Jason Milligan. Welcome back, welcome aboard. I am now returned from my multi-week road trip around the western United States, and I have five new future episodes recorded featuring people from Utah and the Pacific Northwest, so look forward to those later this year in the spring and summer. Our guest today is Jerry Nicholsberg. He first appeared on this podcast back in Season 3, Episode 55, The Caving Roundtable, so longtime listeners may recognize his name. He is a father, grandfather, professor, economist, caver, mountaineer, scuba instructor, tech diver, backpacker, and all-around general outdoorsman. So why don't you come with me to his home in Malibu in Southern California, where we had lots to discuss. Everything from childhood epiphanies, the Boy Scouts, mountain climbing, exploring beneath the seas and beneath the earth, hiking the Grand Canyon rim to rim to rim, canoeing the boundary waters, and yes, even the very rare and unique activity of whitewater scuba diving.
I've been involved with the outdoors since I was a kid, since about age 11 when I went on my first camping trip in the Appalachian Mountains of Virginia. Loved to go camping and hiking. I did a lot of backpacking. I did climbing. I did, as I look back on it, silly stuff like free soloing. Then later became very involved in scuba.
Where you continue to do silly stuff?
Some people might think I continue to do silly stuff. But I have to have many years before I look back on it and say, oh, that was not really very bright. I've been involved with scuba for many, many years and became a scuba instructor and a technical diver and a shipwreck diver. Like mountaineering and have done climbing all over the world and still do a lot of hiking. A number of years ago, I became involved in caving and cave exploration. I've been on cave expeditions to Belize and to the Philippines. And I'm a trustee for two caves in Sequoia National Park. So sort of all over the gamut of doing activities in nature, I find it's a place that centers me and brings me to my equilibrium.
Because you just named a lot of things that you do or have done. But what you also haven't mentioned is your professional life, where you are a professor, correct?
Correct. So I am a professor at UCLA, and I run a research institute, and we do economic forecasting. I'm a professor of economics. And I have worked for the Federal Reserve, and I've had a career in aerospace. So like my career outside, I've jumped around quite a bit.
And you're also a father and a grandfather, right?
I am a father and a grandfather, yes.
Yeah, so there are a lot of things. So one of the things we're definitely going to talk about is how you have managed to juggle all these things in life. Because what most human beings that I meet say at some point while I'm talking to them is, well, I just don't have the time for whatever. People make a lot of excuses for why they don't do a lot of things. And you are one of those people who have seemed to find a way to make the time to do a variety of things while also maintaining a career, while also being a father and grandfather and all of those things.
I think it's a matter of setting priorities and how badly you want to do things. There are always times when you can make excuses, and there are always excuses, and they're good excuses. One of the things that I realized, for example, going out hiking when you have to get up for an alpine start, is that when you're waking up, you say to yourself, I could just sleep another hour or 2 hours.
Absolutely. Or five more minutes.
Or then, five more minutes turns out to be 2 hours, right? Yeah. And, you know, what I say to myself is, you don't want to get up now, but you've never been unhappy that you did.
Right.
You have many times been unhappy that you missed out And so that's kind of the motivation. So you drag yourself out of bed and then you're quite happy that you did it. So it's a matter of setting priorities, having some discipline to follow through with them, being organized. All of those things really help. And I think a key element, at least in my career and my life, has been a keen interest in learning new things, learning how to do new things, learning how things work. And so that's also a driving force, and having new experiences as well.
So what I would like for us to do is run through the timeline of your life. So you grew up in Virginia? Is that what I'm hearing?
I'm a native Californian. As a kid, we moved to Virginia. And so I grew up in Virginia, and we moved before I was outside in other than a stroller.
So the years that really would be impactful in your life, at that point, you had moved to Virginia.
That's correct.
And you said 11?
11 was my first camping trip, yes.
And what did that look like?
So that was interesting. That was, a point of real discovery for me. I had quite a troubled childhood. My parents said, he's really smart. Let's advance him in school. Mm-hmm. So this was definitely part of it. Everyone in my class was a year and a half to 2 years older than me.
So they did the skip the grade thing for you.
And right. it was basically a grade and a half. So I was always the youngest by far. And, there was always this, you're just a baby. You don't know. You know how kids are. I wasn't bullied, because I wouldn't take crap from anybody. Mm-hmm. Had my share of letting them know that. So I didn't have that bad experience. But, there was a sense of, not belonging. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I didn't belong, right? My classmates were in the Boy Scouts. This was a military community, predominantly military community. And they were in the Boy Scouts. And they'd wear their uniforms to class on the day that they had meetings. And so when I turned 11, I had the opportunity to do that.
Oh, so this wasn't a family trip. This was a Boy Scouts trip.
Right. Okay. Well, I just wanted to belong, and they mm-hmm. wore the uniforms as a military community. Mm-hmm. I need to wear a uniform and be kind of part of the crowd, right? And so I did that, and I was a tenderfoot, and I thought this was the dumbest thing going. And, we went to meetings. We had to do the Boy Scout oath, and I'm thinking, I'm never going to do this stuff, I mean, I was, poster child for at risk. And then we had this camping trip coming up, first camping trip, and it was to a place called Lawrence's Farm. I thought, we're going camping at Lawrence's Farm, at some dude's farm, mm-hmm. right? This is, again, very stupid.
But at least you got a really great uniform out of it.
Yeah, but I mean, I can't back out now, right? We got me some camping equipment and an old surplus army rucksack. And we get in the car and we're driving through these farmland in Virginia. And I'm sitting there, everybody's excited, and I'm sitting there like, this is so dumb. This is so effing dumb.
Is it safe to say you were one of those kids who thought you were smarter than everyone else?
It's safe to say I was unhappy that I was.
Okay.
I mean, that was kind of part of it. I didn't have to think that. People would keep telling me that, and mm-hmm. I go, no, you guys don't get it.
So I was one of those kids who also annoyingly would get labeled as like, he's the smart one, which one was annoying, and I would rather they just shut up. But two, reason I'm bringing this up is to see if you had this same experience. The immediate response of whatever kid, and this always happened, was told I was the smart kid, was to then ask me a math problem that was very easy, as if that was the trial and the proof of whether I would be intelligent. Like, for instance, it would be, he's a smart kid. Oh, really? What's 10 times 10?
Yeah.
What would happen to you also?
Sure. But then, I would respond, let's go paint graffiti on the principal's door. And they go, maybe he's not so smart.
So safe to say, in some ways, you were not.
And maybe that's still true. So then, so we're driving down this back road in Virginia, and the cars stop, and we're told to get out, and we get our backpacks. I'm going, what are we doing? So, well, it's a mile to Lawrence's Farm. And I go, we have perfectly good cars here. and we're going to walk down the road to Lawrence's Farm. This gets dumber every moment. And so, we started walking down there. And I don't know, you just went on a trip back east. The forests in Virginia are jungle-like.
Right, they're much more thick. Yeah.
They're very thick. They're lush. And we walked for about 5 minutes, and we make a left turn and go into the forest. And it was like an epiphany. Oh, I feel like I'm home. This is amazing. That was a big deal in my life and really changed my life right at that moment at age 11. Obviously, I've continued to experience the outdoors. It gives me equilibrium. It gives me serenity. And it's fun and always interesting. But that was a start. It was this troubled kid finds that there are trees and forest and beauty in the world. And we did end up camping in his farmyard, which was pretty stupid, but it was a totally impactful introduction to the wilderness.
Did you continue going out with the Boy Scouts?
I did. I mean, the Boy Scouts provided this structure where I could do that.
And the uniform.
And the uniform and a sense of belonging. But, you know, I kind of moved into some leadership roles and got involved with, wildlife and hunting snakes and climbing. And so it was, it really was the pathway.
So when you moved into climbing, so climbing has evolved a lot in your lifetime, right?
A lot.
Yeah. So what did that look like? And how young are we talking when you got introduced into climbing?
So that's hard to say. You know, in the Boy Scouts, you would hike up.
Or like scramble something.
But then I would see things that I wanted to climb, and I would just go and do them. And that would be the free soloing that I would do. I didn't have any instruction on that. There wasn't kind of any pathway. I said, that looks cool, and I can do that. And fortunately, I was able to do it.
And are we talking substantial stuff? Are we talking 30, 40 feet, or we're talking 200 feet? Or
and we're kind of talking the ladder.
Okay, so you'd see something very tall and then decide to ascend it.
In Virginia, well, between Virginia and Maryland is the Potomac River, and there's a place called Great Falls. And there's some really cool rocks. Fortunately, they're bomber rocks. But they're above the falls, and they get the mist of the falls, so they're kind of wet. Mm-hmm. There, you only get up maybe 30, 40 feet above, but you might as well be 1,000 feet if you slip.
Right, right.
So that was the kind of stuff when I said, oh, I did silly stuff. I mean, looking back, shouldn't have been up there.
There's this weird thing when you're a kid, though, is you're too dumb to know better, and for some reason that protects you. It's like if you had just a little more knowledge that you could hurt yourself, you would hurt yourself.
Well, I think that confidence is really important, right? That if you overthink things, and it runs all throughout life, it's not just what we're talking about. If you overthink things, then that creates hesitation and creates mistakes.
Right. It's why I can't throw a football. It's because I try to throw a football, something weird happens, so then I think about how I'm supposed to do it or what I think I'm supposed to do, and I spend so much time trying to figure out how to throw it that I just get worse and worse at throwing it.
Right. And if you were in sort of the zen of football,
which is not likely to ever occur to me.
Yeah. But then it would happen.
Right.
And so I think, when I was doing this kind of climbing, I was in the zen of it. I knew that I could do it. Obviously felt invincible. Clearly I wasn't invincible, but it felt invincible. And so I didn't have the hesitation that you would otherwise have.
Was that the type of climbing you mostly did? Or did at some point you get introduced into technical climbing? Because I know at some point in your life you have done technical climbing because I've watched you do it. But was that something you came upon in childhood or much, much later in life?
No, much later. I actually stopped doing class 5 climbing without ropes and for a long time. And then much later, I actually got introduced to modern climbing. And then I took some REI classes and learned the ropes, right? Learned how to climb that way. But that was much, much later, many years.
Now you know enough to know that you'll kill yourself if you try to solo anything.
Absolutely.
So you've lost the ability to do it at this point. Not because of any physical reason, but just because of the knowledge that you will kill yourself.
I mean, that's kind of true. Mm-hmm. When I was climbing Bora Peak in Idaho, there are a couple of places where there's class 4 and there's one class 5 move. But the rock was bomber, and I was totally confident that I could do it. But that's maybe the only time sort of in sort of this part of my life when I've done that. But, at least I knew, check the rock. If it's like the San Gabriel Mountains, don't do it.
For people who don't know the San Gabriels and don't know Southern California, they're known for being choss piles that will break apart within your hand very easily.
Everything breaks off.
Yeah. You'll probably enjoy this. I think it was maybe last year. I was running some stupid little canyon no one does. And I was down climbing this little section. I was in the San Gabriels. It all broke free. And then the reason I didn't slide all the way down to the ground, which wasn't terribly far below, was because a yucca caught me. Like, thankfully not the sharp ends of the yucca, but the long trunk of the yucca caught me on the crotch before I hit the ground. So you grew up in Virginia. You go out with the Boy Scouts. Mm-hmm. You think it's totally stupid, and then you have this epiphany where you realize, right. Oh, actually, there's this really amazing opportunity here. You start exploring the area. You start climbing things you probably shouldn't have been climbing. At some point, you leave Virginia, correct? Is that because school?
School.
Okay. Because I'm assuming you moved there for family reasons. Like, it sounds like maybe was your father in the military or something? Is that what brought you there?
Yeah. So my father had a job in Virginia, in a place called Langley. We know what Langley is. Langley is the center of the U.S. intelligence services.
Oh, okay.
And so we moved for that. When I was in the Boy Scouts, I learned to canoe, and then I became a canoe instructor. And so when I was in Minnesota, we would go up to the Boundary Waters and go on extended canoe trips. And that was really great fun.
Tell us about the Boundary Waters, because it's one of those places I want to visit. I've never been to. And people speak about it as if it is a wonderland of water in the U.S.-Canadian border.
There are two areas. It's really kind of geographically the same area, but we have this artificial national border. And it is the Boundary Waters, which is in Minnesota, and Ketiko National Park, which is in Ontario. And it is a series of lakes in a mountainous region. They're low mountains. They've been worn down. You rent a canoe and you know, take your supplies for the week. What you do is you go to kind of the end of a lake, and you have portages where you carry your gear over, you carry your canoe over, and you're into the next lake. You go through two portages, or you go through a difficult portage. Like, we always would go to the portage that was a mile long and had about 550 feet of gain. No one would do that. And then you're by yourself in the wilderness. It's just pristine wilderness. And so it's, you know, really wonderful. And you pitch your camp wherever you want, you know, on the shore. Mm-hmm. You hear moose going through the forest at night. Sounds like a bulldozer. There are mosquitoes of all different sizes, including some called no-see-ums, which will go right through your net. Mm-hmm. But it is absolutely gorgeous and peaceful. And you can go all the way into Canada, no passport needed. You just have to do enough portages to get there.
Oh, so they don't have a Mountie on a kayak?
They don't have a Mountie on a kayak.
Waiting to check your passport. So you're in Minnesota for college then at that point?
Yeah, and then I come to California after that.
You complete school, and why do you go to California?
I got a position on the faculty at USC here in Southern California, University of Southern California. And okay. I wanted to come back to California. We had vacationed in California because my family, you know, we're all Californians, even though my father moved us to Virginia. So It was a place that I wanted to come to. And, you know, California has spectacular mountains and beaches, and was a place that I wanted to be. Also, if you live in Minnesota for any period of time, you realize there are places that are not that cold.
Yeah. In the time you were there, did you ever, speaking of how cold it would get, did you ever visit the Apostle Islands region or the, because I know they also get iced over caves.
I have visited the Apostle Islands, In fact, as recently as about 3 years ago. But never the caves in the Apostle Islands.
How did you find the visiting the islands in and of themselves? Because, I mean, as a person that was spending time in the Boundary Water, do you go to the Apostle Islands and then they still impress you, or do they not compare?
Well, they're very different, right? Because the Apostle Islands are coastal, a little more comparable to Isle Royale, you know, which is the smallest national park and is out in Lake Superior.
Is that Michigan still at that point? I forget.
It is part of Michigan, but the shortest route to get there is from Duluth. But we went from Houghton, Michigan, in the Upper Peninsula, and, you know, more like that. And I went and I backpacked. It's a 50-mile-long island, and I backpacked one end to the other. And that was, you know, if you ever get a chance to do that, you should. You get up on the spine. And so you hike down the spine, and you've got, you know, the lake on both sides, and there are berries everywhere. And so you pick berries and eat them as you go. And yeah, it was really, really quite a good experience.
And one of the things I've noticed for the few times I've visited the Great Lakes is that they do sincerely feel like an ocean. So I've got to imagine while you're hiking that you feel like you're on an island in the ocean less than you're on an island in a lake.
Yeah, definitely. The Waves on the Great Lakes are very much like ocean waves.
Eric and I were on that road trip recently, and we were passing through Michigan, and we stopped to have lunch at this little beachside area. Probably, I think it was still Lake Superior at that point. Everything told me we were staring into the ocean, from the waves to the seabirds and everything. Yeah.
When we got to the end of the island, we rented a canoe, and they said, you know, you can only go this far in kind of the bay, but there was a shipwreck outside of the bay. So we went out to that, and when we passed through, you know, kind of the calmer area of the bay, it really is very ocean-like. The interesting thing about the shipwreck was that the water was crystal clear, and the wreck was only maybe 20 feet below the surface.
Oh, so did you swim down to it?
No, because did you go swimming in Lake Superior?
I did not, no.
It is very cold.
Oh, I would assume. But yeah. But as we're going to get to, things that stop other people from doing things don't always stop you.
If I had had a wetsuit, I would have dove to the shipwreck. You know, the problem with stripping down and jumping into 35-degree water, and then getting back in the boat with wind. At least at this point in my life, I realize there's this thing called hypothermia, and it's not something that you would like to have.
Yeah, it's not pleasant.
at best, it's unpleasant.
So when do you get into diving? Has this happened by the time you've gone to the Boundary Waters, or does that happen once you come to California? Because I know that's a big part of your life.
Later, after I came to California. And, you know, this was sort of another epiphany. I went on a resort dive. So if you're at a resort, they have these resort dives where they supposedly teach you a little bit about diving.
They just teach you how to not sue them, right? They teach you enough so you don't die and sue them?
They say enough so that they can say they taught you enough in case you sue them.
What resort would this have been? Is this like
this
in Mexico or something?
In Jamaica.
Jamaica, okay.
And you know, and we went out, started diving, and I just thought to myself, my parents wasted so much money on college, because if they'd just given me scuba lessons, I would have been a scuba bum all my life. It was, you know, it was another one of these, this is a different world, and this is just really amazing, and I just feel so comfortable and at home here. And so that was the start of my scuba career.
It is an interesting experience, because you're buoyant. You're underwater, so there's almost like that sense of floating, or not quite flying, but like floating.
And then it is kind of really like flying, because you're in a three-dimensional world. You've separated yourself from this two-dimensional world where gravity holds us to the ground, right?
Right. Everything around you, like, is counter to what you're used to. Like, it really does feel like an alien environment. One time I really felt that way was when we did that manta ray night dive in Kona. Have you done that
one? In Kona, yeah.
Because manta rays look like an alien creature.
And they're huge.
Yes. And as they come at your face, like, it just doesn't feel like you're seeing something you've ever seen in your life or that exists on this planet.
And for those who've never been diving, particularly in the cold waters here in California, if you've seen James Cameron's Avatar, James Cameron is an avid diver, and the things on Pandora are what you see underwater.
Right.
That's where he took all of those images. That's how cool it is.
That's the inspiration for those things. Yeah, because it does feel like an alien world. So you get introduced in Jamaica, which should be considerably warmer than California water. But it sounds like you were not certified on this trip. This was like a Discover Scuba kind of equivalent sort of situation. So you go on that trip, you enjoy that. So then does that mean you come back and you say, all right, let me go get certified and do more of this? Or just does some time pass and you forget about it and then it comes back into your brain one day?
No, it was the former. In fact, my second dive that I ever did, I used 10 Jamaican dollars as my certification card. I wanted to go diving, and the guy said no. And I said, but I want to go diving. And he said, but you're not certified. And I handed him $10, and he said, be at the dock at 9 o'clock. Things work differently there. So, yes, I did my certification, my basic certification, really as soon as I got back. This is something that I wanted to do.
Did you do your certification dives out here, say like Santa Barbara or Catalina or one of those?
I did. So I did my certification in Santa Monica for the pool work and the classroom. And then we went off the beach here in Malibu. And then we went to Catalina and did the balance of the dives. So it was all cold water diving in 7mm wetsuits.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. So it must have been quite of a different experience when you get in the much colder water, but also probably visibility was probably much better in Jamaica, I would assume as well, right?
It depends. In the winter in California, visibility is better than in the tropics.
Oh, really?
We have sometimes 100-foot days here. But as soon as it warms up, or if we have storms, the visibility is really very poor. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a mixture. When we were doing the certification dives, visibility was pretty good. It was maybe 20 to 30 feet, and that's not tropical visibility. It's much less, but it is definitely sufficient.
I did my certification dives out of Catalina, and I think it was like a 20-foot visibility day. And it's interesting because you very much feel like you're in a bubble.
Yes.
It's like this circular sphere around you. You can see it pretty much the same distance in all directions, and then it's just murk, and you can't tell what's there at all. And that, along with the kelp forest. Yeah, so you've got the kelp forest obscuring your view. You've got limited visibility, but it is a pretty amazing environment there.
It really is. And you know there's something out there. Maybe you don't know, but you're swimming, and then kind of through the mist, things appear.
It's like this undersea forest, this weird undersea forest.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you done any diving right off of Anacapa?
I have, yes.
So I've done some snorkeling there, and I feel like in my limited dive experience in California, some of the best things I've seen underwater were right outside of Anacapa there.
I think this is true everywhere. But here in Southern California, we have Anacapa, which is actually three islands, but it's sort of characterized as one. Mm-hmm. And Catalina, they're not very far from each other, but the ecology is totally different. And you keep going kind of out that chain of Channel Islands, and the ecology changes one to another. So that's really neat. And there's some very cool things to see and experience off of Anacapa.
So how quickly did you go from just your typical open water certification to go get your advanced? Then sounds like, did you move to dive master as well?
I moved to technical dive master and instructor and technical diver.
So that took about everything.
Yeah. And that took a number of years, including cave diving instruction. But you want to build up to that. So the next step after open water certification is advanced, and then you get rescue. Then you go to a professional route, which is dive master and scuba instructor, professional instructor. But then I also did technical training. So that's for going very deep, for penetrating shipwrecks, doing cave diving, and the like.
And you've gone diving across the globe at this point, correct?
Yes, I have.
So what are some of the standouts?
Some of the standouts. In the South China Sea is a battleship, a British battleship, called the Repulse. And the sinking of the Repulse by the Japanese in World War II ended the era of battleships. And it's quite deep, but incredibly beautiful, has all kinds of soft corals on it. There's still a lot in it, so that stands out. In the North Atlantic is the wreck of the Andrea Doria, which was a luxury liner that sunk in around 1953, I think. And that's a very deep dive, very challenging dive. It's dark. There are swirling currents, but it's, also very cool. I think one of the real standouts was the Empress of Ireland, which is up in the Gulf of St. Lawrence in Canada, in Quebec. It was hit by an icebreaker in 1914, and the largest loss of passenger life of any maritime accident was there. It went down in 14 minutes at midnight. So really tragic, but the water's so cold there that it's perfectly preserved. And so that was, quite an interesting dive. And there's a book called, I think it's Deep Descent, that talks about this dive. And so that was one of them that was, really interesting and quite fun.
So when you go down to a dive like that, at some point in the past, has someone come through and removed the bodies?
For the Andrea Doria, of which there wasn't a lot of loss of life. Actually, the loss of life amongst divers going to the Andrea Doria is now approaching the loss of life on the ship, because it took a long time to go down. And in fact, there were film crews out there watching it sink, and there were all kinds of rescue ships. And mostly the people who died on impact with the Stockholm, which was the ship that hit it. On the Empress of Ireland, they had hard hat divers went down and recovered bodies. So you usually don't see them. If you're diving shipwrecks, occasionally you'll see some bones.
Because I know it's preserved in the sense that like all the items that were on board have not been removed.
Yeah.
Whatever state it was in, it is in that state, you know, at least as much as it can be being underwater for long periods of time. But I would imagine if you suddenly stumbled upon a corpse, that would change your experience immediately.
It does. And the one that I'm thinking of was a Japanese destroyer. It had broken in two and flipped over, and I'm going inside in the part that was bottom up, and I swim in, and you know, I'm looking around, and I go, that's a skeleton. It was a little freaky, but then, you know, also it's kind of, it's time to really be respectful. You know, this dude died there. Mm-hmm. And so I think I want to be really careful around this and not disturb anything.
So you've mentioned a lot of wreck dives as the standouts, which is a thing when I've talked to other divers who get into wreck diving, seem to really enjoy. Are there standouts that aren't wrecks to you, reefs that stand out, or most well-known being the Blue Hole in Belize, or any of the natural diving areas stand out to you?
Yes, off the coast of Borneo, there's an island, and I went diving there, and it's not a blue hole, but a very deep wall. And that's where the hammerhead sharks come, and they create a vortex. They swim in a circle. That really stands out. Also, on the coast of Borneo, I was swimming along one time, and I felt something large near me. You know, you just have a sense. And I turned my head to the left, and there was a shark twice my size swimming next to me. And I turn my head back, and there's one on my right, and there's one below me. I'm in a school of sharks. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what do you do? You say, well, I'm lunch, but I'm going to enjoy my, you know, last time before I'm lunch. So I swam along with them, and it was beautiful. It was magnificent. And after a little while, they all turned and left, and I guess, you know, they didn't have ketchup or something because I wasn't lunch.
It's interesting because I was just talking to someone earlier this week on the show who has gotten specifically into shark diving. She went on a dive, encountered sharks, and then was so enamored by the experience that she seeks out these shark dive experiences. So I'm sure this experience for you was interesting, but did it intrigue you in the same way to where you wanted to repeat that experience?
I would repeat the experience. They are magnificent animals. They are so beautiful, strong, and they swim, they glide easily. So I'm always happy when I see sharks. And of course, there are two kinds of sharks. We have a lot of sharks here off the coast of California that are non-pelagic. That is, they stay down on the reef and, you know, they'll come up and they'll eat something. Mm-hmm. But they're not aggressive at all. And the big sharks that we think about, the great whites and the like, are pelagic, so they tend to be deep water, hammerhead sharks, and so on. And so when you see those, that's pretty exciting, but I mean, they're just magnificent.
So have you had any experiences that were not positive under the water, or where you really had to use some of these skills that you've been taught because of a mishap or because something went wrong or something unexpected occurred?
So, you know, we always had this rule, two rules of doing these very aggressive technical dives where, you know, where there is significant risk. And those rules mitigated the risk quite a bit. The first rule was if three things go wrong on the boat or in the water, no matter how minor, the dive is over with. Because one of the things that you see in accident analysis is stuff cascades. It's right. Not one thing. It starts cascading. So if we've got three things, again, no matter how minor, it's not going right. I don't want to take a chance for it to cascade into something kind of bad. And the other rule was, if for any reason either of us feels like this isn't happening, we don't feel that well, or, you know, whatever the reason is, we can call the dive, end the dive, no questions asked, indeed will be happy that our dive partner called the dive because it was something that was happening with them. That's a safety thing. Those really reduce the risk dramatically. It is common in scuba to see, for example, on scuba boats and when you go to resorts, people skip the checklist. In your certification, you get a checklist and you have to go through and they have these funny acronyms and then people go, I'm good, and they jump in. Always do your checklist. Right? So you do these things to mitigate the risk, and then yes, things have happened. They do happen, but you are able to extricate yourself safely.
But you've never been in some situation where you've had to do like an emergency ascent or anything like that, or been in a group where someone made a terrible mistake that you've then got to try to rescue them or anything like that?
You know, the former, no. Mm-hmm. I have called dives quite a few times, but never been in a position where I'm in real trouble and I need to bail out because I tend to be conservative when I dive. In terms of other people and rescues, I've done a number of scuba rescues, yeah. And they're not fun.
What typically causes that need for rescue?
A couple of things. I mean, they're really different, but out of air or going to be out of air. You know, today we have computers and people dive by computer. And two things can happen. One is the computer can die. And you don't know what your situation is because you haven't looked at the computer since you jumped in the water. So you don't know how long you've been down. You don't know. The other is, the computer will take you into decompression, which means that you can't come directly to the surface. You have to come up to a specific depth to stay there for a while so that your body off-gasses the nitrogen that is taken up. And then you go, you keep going slowly to the surface. And the computers really are not the right tool for doing decompression diving. There's kind of advisory. And so, you know, I've been in a situation where the person says, okay, I've gone into decompression. I've got 10 minutes. But by the time they get to where they're stopped, now it's up to 30 minutes. And they don't have enough air. Those are instances where you can do the rescue. If you have enough air yourself, or if you can go
like
in
a buddy breathe sort of scenario.
Yeah. So you donate your air to the person who needs more air. You need to get them calmed down and you need to get them to realize that they are not going to die. Mm-hmm. And then you can help them get through their decompression and get to the surface safely.
It sounds like this would probably be more likely when you're doing your deeper, more technical dives.
No, it's more...
Really?
It's more often when you're doing dives in recreational limits.
So within the 60-foot depth?
Oh, within 100 feet.
Or 100, okay.
Yeah. So, over in Catalina, you can easily get to 100, 110 feet from the water park there. And that stuff happens. Had that. People not watching their depth. We were supposed to, and this was a guided dive, we were supposed to go to 90 feet, and it was on a wall, and we descended to 90 feet, and so people are sort of stopping at 85, 90 feet, and I'm there, and I see this guy coming down, and I'm thinking, he's not paying any attention, and he blows right through 90 feet, and he's still not paying attention. He has one tank. By the time he realizes it, he's probably dead. So, there I just flipped over and kicked down as fast as I could and grabbed him, and I grabbed him at about 20 feet deeper. His eyes got really wide. What? I'm this deep. But, that kind of thing happens. And that's where you get scuba accidents.
That makes a lot of sense because especially when you're in an area where it's just straight deep water and there's no point of reference.
Exactly.
If you're not watching that gauge, it is impossible as a human to figure out how deep you've descended or how far you've moved in lateral space or
you have
anything
no idea.
Else.
Yeah. You absolutely have no idea. You have no reference points.
Right.
So you have to, you have to follow your gauges, just like an airplane pilot flying in a fog.
Right. And if you're inexperienced, it's going to be even more easy to do that.
Sure.
Sounds like this guy probably was.
Yeah, very inexperienced. And in the training class, they don't say, trust your gauges, don't trust your senses. Because the gauges will tell you the real truth.
Right.
And your senses won't.
So we've just set up how you're very knowledgeable, experienced, and a safe person. So let's shift to a silly thing. as we mentioned earlier.
Ringbolt Rapids.
Yeah. Why don't you tell us about, and I'm pretty sure we're about to talk about breaks all the rules of scuba diving. So tell us about how you decided to start diving whitewater rivers.
So I read about this guy who was doing this, and he had a dive shop. So I contacted him, and he said, we can go out. And so I arranged to go out with them. And we put in, and we're going upstream, and this is on the Colorado River. And, he says, well, it's really running today. And it was two of them. He was going to stay in the boat, and this other guy was going to go with me. And he keeps talking like that. And I said, so are you telling me not to go? And he said, well, it's your decision. And I said, well, would you dive it? And he said, well, yeah. Fine. It was really interesting. I just kind of wanted to see what it was about. The thing about it is there were two rules for this. One was do not come to the surface, because in the surface you're going to be in this boiling water in the rapids, and you're going to be in trouble. You're not going to be able to get down below the water, and you're not going to be able to get out. You're going to be in trouble. And you're going to be tossed and do somersaults and all kinds of things, and you'll hit rocks, and it would be a bad scene. I said, fine, I can do that. I got it. The other, he said, which kind of blew my mind, was you'll see yourself careening into a rock. Do not try and avoid it, because water doesn't compress, and your body will be pushing water against the rock, and it will form a soft, non-compressed surface, and it'll take you right around the rock. That was the strangest thing.
To get into what we're talking about here, so when a person, say, goes whitewater rafting, they're told, hey, if you fall out of the boat, you want to either try to swim back to the boat or swim to shore. But in certain situations, that's not the right decision. It's ride the rapid, and you never go face first. You get into a lawn chair position with your feet in front of you, yeah, so you can press off of the rocks. But for what we're talking about, that is absolutely not what you need to do. You are going face first, underwater, letting the current carry you down whitewater.
Right. And so when you're on the top, you have air. You have air and water and mm-hmm. Air change, and you're on a, kind of a shear plane, and that changes all of the dynamics. Underwater, it's just the water. Now, I admit, I had my hands up, next to my face, hoping that I would hit the rock with my hands first before it knocked me out and killed me. But it worked. I mean, you don't hit the rock. You glide around it. And after the first couple of rocks, it was sort of cool, and I took my hands away from my face. And it was, it was an interesting experience. I think I learned a lot from it.
So one thing, though, back to these rocks. So yes, the water is going to carry you around the rocks, but the water can still fit in spaces your body cannot. Was this never a problem? Did you never encounter a pile of rocks that had too thin of a space for a human body to get through?
No, not really. I mean, the water compresses and creates a cushion around all of these rocks.
Yeah, so it's like a pile of rocks will have essentially like a force field around it.
Right.
Okay.
And that kind of compression, I don't know if you've noticed, when you fly, as the airplane is coming into the airport, it kind of floats right before it lands. Mm-hmm. Because it's compressed the air. The same thing is happening there.
Okay.
But the water is, much less compressible than air. Then you just, okay, I'm in for the ride for however long this is. I have no idea however long this is, but I'm in for the ride until I'm through the rapids.
And then you just surface at an eddy at some point and then exit?
This is my only rapids dive, because reasonable people don't do this. So this one was, you end up in one of these non-releasing vortices. And so that was the other instruction. When you get there, let it take you all the way to the bottom, which is the way that you get out of them.
And
I know that in canyoneering with swift water, mm-hmm. You're supposed to learn that. You go all the way to the bottom, and then you come up the side on the other side, where you're outside of the vortex. And you get to the bottom, and it's absolutely still. And that's when you say, oh, so I'm through the rapids. Now I need to swim over to the side here and come up. And you come up, and you're in laminar water. And And then we floated down the water and looked at the fish and some really ancient fish, and it was pretty cool.
Yeah. So what was your takeaway from this experience?
Well, you know, I learned a lot, you know, as I'm talking about it, that these are the things that I learned, right? You know, it's just an enjoyable new experience, very different, probably not something that one should really do. And I think very few people have, for good reason, but these two guys had done it quite a few times, mm-hmm. and I wanted to understand what they were doing and why. The why I never got to, but the what they were doing I understood.
Well, what was the why for you? Just curiosity?
It was curiosity, mm-hmm. yeah, yeah.
And so at some point they must have appeased that curiosity, but they continued.
They did, and you know, and part of it was, so what's going on there underwater?
Right.
Are there fish? You know, what is happening there?
I've got to imagine it's an extremely unique experience.
Definitely.
And I could definitely see how there could be valuable data there for science, mm-hmm. and naturalism, or yeah, just to see, yes, like you're saying, what is happening, what is functioning underneath
below the rapids.
Yeah.
And they have to be rapids in a river that is deep enough.
Right.
So the Colorado River certainly is. You know, rivers that say you're only 5-8 feet as you go across the rapids, and you know, when you do whitewater rafting, a lot of times you're just skimming the rocks.
Yeah, yeah.
Those would not be sufficient. You need that depth. And you know, and so there was a real learning experience to this.
And you decided to not repeat it.
I'd done that particular rapids, and to my knowledge, no one else is diving rapids anywhere else in the world.
so it's hard to repeat.
So I've done the universe of whitewater scuba.
So as we talked about earlier, some of the other things that you take part in is caving and mountaineering. So what was the road to both or either of those? Are those connected in any way for you? Yes. The way you got involved into them?
No, I mean, I've been climbing mountains in the sense of hiking to the top, mm-hmm. of mountains, and sometimes, you know, actually doing class 3, class 4 mountains sort of all my life. And so I worked in Seattle for 2 years. And if you work in Seattle, when it's not raining, you see this most magnificent mountain, Mount Rainier. I was looking at it thinking, I really, really need to climb that. Well, you don't just go out and climb it. And so that started me on technical mountaineering, so glacier travel and the like. Caving, what got me into caving was that, you mentioned that I do have grandchildren. Mm-hmm. I took my grandson to a cave called Cave of the Winds in Colorado, near Colorado Springs, near Manitou Springs. And we wanted to go on the tour, but the tour was booked, but they had something called a wild tour. And that was not booked, so I said, let's go on that, which was really fun. And, you know, growing up in Virginia, in the Appalachians and in the Shenandoah, there are lots of caves, lots of show caves. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I knew that they were pretty cool. And I'm not claustrophobic, which helps a lot.
It's definitely one of the many ways you and I are different.
Yeah. And, you know, we're going through this, and our guide keeps talking about his grotto. And I'm thinking, what is a grotto? So at the end, I said, you kept talking about your grotto. What is it? He says, well, it's a caving club. We go out and we explore wild caves, and, you know, we find new caves and the like. And I said, so that's, you know, here in Colorado. He said, well, you know, they're kind of all over. If you go on the National Speleological Association's website, you can find one near you. So I got back home and I looked, and there was a Southern California grotto. And I called up the number there, and they said, yeah, come on down to the meeting. And that started me on caving. And the first underground trip that I did with our friend Carl was to the Las Flores gold mines. And that was my first underground. First time I really realized that I wasn't claustrophobic, that I could feel rock all around my body. Mm-hmm. And that sort of started me on my caving career. So there are different trajectories. There is climbing involved in caving. Sometimes there's free climbing, and some of the caves you have to do some free climbing to set the rigging. I got really interested in rigging and learned how to be a rigger. So that was the kind of the beginning of my caving career.
And as you said, you have gone on a few expeditions around the world, specifically for caving. So how did those come about? Was it because of the grotto? The grotto put an expedition together? Or how did you become a member of that expedition?
So the two of them that I went on, one was to the Philippines, which was not a true expedition, but we were looking for new caves and connections to existing caves. And the purpose for this was to document where water is going so that upstream users of the water, farmers and the like, would not be polluting the water for downstream, because they would know that their water was going through this cave system and coming out, you know, miles away. And so we went, and this was cave diving, went exploring caves that were emptying into the ocean to try and find the connections. The other, the Belize expeditions, had been going on for a while, and I signed on for one of them, and that was partly connected, but in a big way, to the Southern California Grotto. Had a lot of friends who were going. That morphed into the Boundary Fault expedition, which one member of our grotto and another fellow from back east are responsible for putting together, and they actually run the expedition. But I've gone on that a number of times, and so that's exploration, and also I have responsibility for rigging, and then when we're taking photographs, I try and be the pretty face in the photograph.
And people listening that can't see his face, if you go to the website, you can see his face, but if you were here, you would see that he is a gorgeous human being.
I look even better covered with cave mud.
So you said the first one included cave diving. Are you also a cave diver?
I am, yes.
So which is more dangerous in your experience? Whitewater?
Whitewater.
Whitewater was more dangerous than cave diving?
Yes.
Really?
Cave diving has a lot of accidents associated with it and a lot of fatalities. And the thing about cave diving is there isn't any, we'll fix it or let's go to the surface and take care of it.
Right.
You know, there are kind of only two outcomes. One is you fix it there and you survive. And the second is you don't survive.
Right.
So, you know, it's risky stuff. But there are lots of ways that you can mitigate those risks. And if you do, it becomes significantly safer. Maybe cave diving is more dangerous. No one has really died diving rapids, but, you know, no one dives rapids.
Right.
Hard to compare the two. But, you know, cave diving, so it combines, you know, my love of diving and my love of caving, mm-hmm. and it's pretty spectacular. But you have to follow the rules.
As we maybe have caught on, you don't necessarily love rules.
Yeah, but there are times when I really follow the rules.
Right, when you respect them.
And you can't be claustrophobic, and you can't be afraid of a complete whiteout where you can't see. You have to know how to handle those situations. And you have to plan carefully, and you have to plan for all contingencies. And, you know, still there is risk. Significant risk, but you know, you can whittle it down to enormous risk, from enormous risk to significant risk.
And you would consider that a reasonable amount of risk? Significant?
Not for everyone.
But for you personally?
Yeah, I mean, everyone has a different degree of risk tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not an adrenaline junkie at all, so I need to feel that I'm in control, that I know what I'm doing, that I know what I'm going to do if things happen that were unplanned. And if that's the case, then those are risks that I'm willing to take.
So when you've gone cave diving, is this a thing that you've done strictly just on that expedition, or have you done other types of cave diving?
I did in the Philippines, in the Yucatan. I've done some sea caves here in Southern California. Haven't done much of late, but I've done, you know, a reasonable amount. Did not become a complete cave diving aficionado.
Right.
And, you know, this is kind of goes back to, I think, your first question. A lot of things interest me, so I have to prioritize what I want to do. And cave diving takes, you know, a fair amount of work and planning and a lot of time, and the caves that you would want to dive are not close to where I live. So that's going to interfere with quite a few other things that I want to do. So that's sort of fallen by the wayside.
And you also mentioned early on that you are, I forget what the term is, it's not a steward of the caves, it's
a trustee.
Yes, the trustee for two separate cave structures?
For two caves in Sequoia National Park.
So how did that come about and what does that entail?
These caves are accessible only if you go with a trustee. And one of them has quite a bit of climbing and rope work, so it's relatively technical. It's not that hard if you know how to do it. I was going a number of times with a friend and mentor of mine, John Woods. You know, he was a trustee, and I said, "Well, you know, how do you become a trustee?" He said, "Well, you have to have training, and I can train you." And so we went to the cave. We did 5 times in the cave, and progressively I was doing more of it. And then, you know, he wrote a report for the Park Service, and they designated me as a trustee then so that I can take other groups into the cave.
And I'm going to switch us now back to mountaineering a little bit, because we just kind of brushed right past that. You were climbing, hiking mountains throughout your life. Mm-hmm. You were in Seattle. You saw Rainier. You wanted to climb Rainier. Did you do that with a guide service, or did you do that?
I did, yes, because you want to be on a rope team for Rainier.
Right.
You know, I don't have the other folks, and I don't know their training levels, right? The first time I went on Rainier, I rented boots because I didn't have mountaineering boots. And I had all the skills to climb Rainier, but these boots were plastic boots, and they didn't fit quite well. And I got a high sprain slash shin bruise that ended my climb at 10,000 feet. A year later, I had boots that I purchased that were not plastic, but were good, you know, good boots, and was able to climb Rainier, and that sort of started me on climbing high mountains.
And since then,
I've climbed Mount Hood. I climbed Kilimanjaro, which is not technical, but it's very high. And I climbed, did some technical climbing in the Alta Mountains in Mongolia.
For those, did you also go with a guide service, or did you have to go develop some of these skills on your own?
Generally, you want to go with a mountain guide if you're going to a mountain that you don't know. There are just too many things that can go wrong. For Mount Hood, that was just Carl and myself. We had studied the mountain. We knew what we were doing. And you know, the mountains in the Sierra, other mountains in, you know, for example, in Arizona, the mountains here, when you're doing mountaineering in the winter, you know, these are mountains I know. And so I go with myself or with a climbing partner. They're technical. I mean, there are avalanches and there's ice and snow, and you need to know how to self-arrest and all of those things that go along with mountaineering. But the, you know, the really big mountains that I don't know, I would go with a guide.
So one of the things you mentioned were your boots tearing up your feet. If you recall, when you and I first met, it was on a overnight backpacking trip down the Grand Canyon.
It's the Grand Canyon,
and then
yes.
Back up. And I recall your toes were the most beat up, black toenails. I used to do ballet, and ballerinas are known for being beautiful and having the most hideous feet you'll ever see. And you may have been in competition with the ballerinas. So what do you do to your feet?
So here's the thing. They still look like that.
Were you just blessed with these beautiful feet, or is this a product of your lifestyle?
It's just part of the beauty. It happens. I mean, when I do hikes like the Grand Canyon, which I've done quite a few times, and that is, you know, for anyone who wants such an incredible place, the Grand Canyon is it. But, you know, if you're hiking 20 plus miles and you're trying to make really good time, there's a real good chance that your toes are going to hit your boots at some point in time. And, you know, you just go, ouch, that hurt. Shouldn't have done that, and keep going. Except your toes say, yeah, you lost that toenail, so they turn black.
I know a lot of people who end up having foot problems, and foot problems are notorious for getting people off of long-distance trails, for incapacitating people for a couple of days, but it seems like you maybe don't have that issue.
Or I ignore it.
That's what I was going to say. Do you just just deal with that pain and you don't become incapacitated at any point?
Yeah,
or
pretty
do
much.
Okay. There's no like special foot care you're doing despite the hideous look of your feet. There's nothing special you're doing to keep them going.
You keep your toenails clipped, right? And you just keep going because, you know, what's the alternative? The alternative is that you miss the adventure. You miss the time out in the wilderness. And that's a trade-off that it's hard to make if you really feel like you not just want to be out there, but kind of need to be out there.
What about blisters and things of that?
I don't really get blisters.
I think you and I are lucky in this way. Like, I'll sometimes get blisters, but they typically just pop and they don't bother
me. Yeah.
But for a lot of people, they seem to completely shut down their hike.
Right. I always carry a duct tape. In the rare cases when I do get blisters, I just slap duct tape on it. And then when I get home, I pull the duct tape off. Blister comes with it, you put medication on it and a bandage, and A week later, you're done.
So your secrets to dealing with foot issues is that you're just lucky that you have the genetics so that they're not really that big of an issue. And
correct.
Secondly, you're willing to put up with what pain there is.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
It doesn't become incapacitating.
Yeah.
So there's no secret you could share with anyone to help anyone else.
There's no secrets.
Except maybe acquire different genetics.
And, you know, it's your tolerance for pain.
So we're mentioning the Grand Canyon, and on that trip, we were going down and up. But I know in other instances, you have hiked rim to rim to rim, correct? In a single push?
Yes.
Probably last time you did that was a few years ago, is that right?
It was pre-COVID. I've done rim to rim since then, but not rim to rim to rim, which is a monster hike.
Right. So tell us about that. Give us the particulars of what that includes, because it's a lot of gain, a lot of loss, and a fair amount of miles. But you also are doing it in a straight push, which means no sleep, no like stopping for elongated periods of time.
So first of all, it takes a lot of planning, because you have to plan your water, you have to plan your food, and you know where you can resupply. And in the Grand Canyon, there are places where you can resupply water. And you have to worry about the timing. And so it takes a good bit of planning. You also don't want to go in August. You want to go when the weather is mostly going to be a bit milder at the bottom, because if you're in the bottom and it's 110 degrees, you're not making it across and back.
Right. And what a lot of people don't realize is it's actually hotter at the bottom of the Grand Canyon
right.
than at the rim.
And there are a lot of rescues in the Grand Canyon because people don't realize that. They maybe only want to go down to the river, as we did on the first trip that we went mm-hmm. on together. And they don't realize that it's that hot. And
there are plenty of signs also that say, don't die, turn around,
right.
don't come down and try to do it in a day,
yeah.
bring more water, and you'll still see people with a tiny little plastic container.
And no hat, in a wife beater shirt.
Right.
Hiking down the bottom, I'm going to the bottom of the canyon. Yeah, and that's really dangerous. So the entire hike is 46 miles. You descend from one rim to the river and then up to the other. You eat something and you go back.
And one side of the rim is what, 5,000 feet high and the other is six?
The north is six.
Mm-hmm.
You have to climb 6,000 feet. And the south, you climb 5,000 feet. So it's an 11,000 foot climb. At the end of the hike, you're doing, well, the way we did it, which was north to south to north, you're ending it going up 6,000 feet. It does strange things to you when you push yourself like that. What we didn't realize, although we had planned for changes in weather, and it was probably 80, 85 at the river. On the way back up, we were climbing through the night and into the morning. We ended up climbing through a blizzard. And so that was, you know, all you can do is just, you know, one step, make sure you're solid. Another step, make sure you're solid.
And I'm going to assume this is going up to the north side?
Going up to the north rim. So this is after we'd done about 5,500 feet of the 6,000 feet. And then we got hit by this blizzard. And when we got up to the top, there was no blizzard. And, you know, needless to say, we were toast. But it was actually a really cool experience.
So one of the things that has kept me from doing something like the rim to rim to rim hike is my knees. For instance, I hiked San Gorgonio a little over a year ago in a day, which is, what, like 19 miles?
19 miles from Vivian Creek, yes.
Right, and then it's like 5,500 up and down.
Right.
And my knees were trashed for months afterwards. Do you experience knee issues?
When you're doing 46 miles, at mm-hmm. some point, your whole body is numb. So maybe, but I didn't feel it. I mean, you know, not really. If they were really bad knee issues, then, you know, that would be cause to stop.
Mm-hmm.
I have had knee injuries before, but you know, not really.
Damn it, Jerry, you're not telling me how to fix people's feet or how to fix my own terrible knees.
Yeah, sorry.
You're supposed to have this knowledge. So I'm going to switch our conversation to a maybe unexpected point, but probably not that unexpected.
Oh, no.
Okay, so we know that you are a person that likes all of these different natural, nature-based activities,
mm-hmm.
but your career is in economics,
right?
Which, maybe I'm wrong, don't seem like paths that would intersect. Well, for one, explain to people what being an economist is, And then explain to me what in your brain makes you interested in both the outdoor world and economics.
Sure, but let me start with the second question.
Okay, sure, go ahead.
It is not unique to me as an academic to be interested in the outdoors and to do outdoor activities. Mm-hmm. It's actually reasonably common. It provides solitude. It provides an alternative to sitting and writing articles or books and teaching and kind of a way to get away. And so that's, I think, not so unusual, even though maybe it sounded unusual in the first place. What is an economist? So economics is really kind of a study of society and how we as people organize ourselves to use the resources around us and how we distribute them amongst ourselves. Resources are not unlimited, even though some of our ancestors and even some people today think there are unlimited resources like air and water, but they're not. So they're limited. And so, you know, how do you best organize that? We have a particular system here in the United States. And what we do as economists in our research is we look at different policies, government policies, and we ask, well, how did that affect the way in which goods and services, income, be allocated amongst people? And is there a better way to do that? Is this harmful? Are there unintended consequences of them? And just as an example, a research project that I am working on now involves the regulations that the state of California is putting on the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach to become green and to have electric trucks that are going in or hydrogen trucks and to have shore power from renewable energy for the ships that are coming in. And all of this sounds great. You know, we need to do this kind of thing in order to stem the production of greenhouse gases into the air. The study we're doing revolves around the choices that owners of ships are making because they don't have to pay the extra cost of coming into Los Angeles and Long Beach. They can go through the Panama Canal to East Coast ports and not have any of that. And so the question is, how many of these are doing that? And what's the net effect? Are we just driving these heavy polluters, which are ocean-going freighters, into much longer trips and creating even more carbon? So that's the kind of thing that we do.
What I think is interesting is kind of what I'm hearing, the way you described what exactly economics is it's kind of like taking sociology and then also mathematics and statistics and bringing them together so that you can make informed decisions that affect society.
Correct. And you know, looking at things historically, how have things like this worked, you know, like what we're interested in worked in the past? And, you know, is the present like the past? Oftentimes it's not. But so, yes, bringing in other aspects of the social sciences with mathematics and statistics, but kind of really focusing on the production of goods and services and their distribution amongst the population. And that's the part that economics deals with.
So why should the general public listen when an economist speaks?
Why should it? It depends on who the economist is. Because economics is, you know, so important in making good public policy, economists do have the access to politicians. And I think one thing that happens is that those who have access to politicians sometimes decide that they like being close to that power center and they are attracted to it and they're corrupted by it. And I think this is why when you listen to economists and you say, well, the economists have two hands, they go on the one hand, on the other hand, you know, no two economists agree. If you stay with the basic analysis, you're going to get widespread agreement, but you get the politicization of economists for outside reasons. And, you know, that should give you pause when you listen to economists, because this definitely happens.
So what was it when you went into college that made you decide to go into that branch of study? Or did you not, and this came along? Do you have is your degree in economics?
It is. So it kind of went like this. I wanted to study geology, but I did not want to traipse around the Amazon looking for oil. So, okay, I need something else. Well, I really like mathematics, but I can't earn a living in mathematics. I kind of like history. Economics is sort of history and mathematics. I think I'll do that. That was the decision.
What's interesting, though, is that you're talking about how you're working on these policies that in the end will affect the natural environment,
right,
which is the other part of your personality.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. So those are definitely connected.
Yeah. So they're not two disparate things that led you there. Your brain is not bifurcated. It is a functioning brain that has brought things that might not seem to go together.
Is it
together.
Really functioning?
Well, you know, we'll leave that up to the audience who's been listening thus far
okay.
to decide what they think. Based on what you've told us, we are getting to the point where we have recorded quite a bit. And so before I get to the last question that I ask, which I think you might already know what it is, I'm going to ask if there's any life experience we haven't covered of yours that you'd like to tell or any story you want to tell, because I know there's plenty more that we haven't talked about. And maybe there's something you're itching to share that we didn't even brush the surface of.
No, not really.
All right. Well, then I'm going to bring us to that last final question, which is, what is the final thought you want to leave the audience with before we go?
If you look at what I've done, it is, you know, simply looking at things that were interesting to me, that were fun, that allowed me to grow intellectually and as a person, and pursuing them. And, you know, you hit on things like knee and foot injuries and the like, and kind of pushing through to really enjoy those experiences, but not pushing through like a cowboy, pushing through in a very measured way so that you learn and you enjoy it. At least that's been my experience.
Well, with that final thought, I want to thank you for letting me come to your house over here in Malibu, not too far from the beach. I thought maybe we could see the ocean. It looked like we were going to as I was driving up, but then you've got trees in the way. But yeah, thanks for sitting down with me and recording this.
You're welcome.
And now we've come to that part of the show where I always invite all of you to go to our website, gogetoutside.com. Look for this episode 116 with Jerry Nicholsberg, and there you will find photographs of Jerry in action and lots of links. Head to the website this time. We have all sorts of links for all of the places and organizations and various places that Jerry talked about. And a reminder to all of you, if you have not gone to our YouTube channel, Go Get Outside Podcast. Now would be a great time to go and subscribe. You can go directly there on YouTube or go to our website, gogetoutside.com, and look for the video section, specifically the YouTube page, because next week will be a new episode of Hometown Explorers. And if you don't know what that is, well, tune in next week here on the feed or go to the YouTube channel and you will find out. Or you can always look back a few episodes and listen to the previous episode of Hometown Explorers. And should you'd like to get in touch with me here at the show, you can do that a number of ways. You can email me, jason@gogetoutside.com, or you can send a text or voice message to 818-925-0106. And as always, please go to your podcast purveyor of choice. Make sure you are subscribed. And if you could, rate and review the show. But most importantly, please share it with someone who you think would enjoy it. Next time on the show, come back April 16th for what is guaranteed to be a fun episode. Fun facts with caver, canyoneer, runner, crossfitter, world traveler, and possibly super spy, Jessica Layla. You are in for a treat. Nearly 2 hours of consistent fun and occasional heartfelt poignancy. April 16th, Jessica Layla. See you then.